Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to there. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because, well, we have this on the line, Mark Black. So we're going to be talking about his organization, SaveMinds.org. We're going to be talking about the terrible tragedy of the children whose minds are being destroyed in America by the use of vaccines, and the fact that there are people within our government who know exactly what they're doing. They know the toxic effect of mercury and the other things in the vaccines, and for some reason, they're concealing that information from the doctors and from the people who could really make a difference. Mark, how did you get involved in this battle?
Well, I got involved because I've got a child that was diagnosed with autism when she was not quite three, and that was about 7 years ago.
How old is she now? She's about 10 now?
Just turned 10 last month.
All right, now, of course, what happened when you went to the doctors? And of course, it's obvious he's not normal. What sort of reaction was she having? Was she beginning to withdraw?
Yeah, she started out life as a normal, typically developing infant. Everything seemed fine. And as a baby, through really her first birthday, everything was moving along. She was interacting. She was starting to speak. She passed all her milestones. And then sometime, and there was no specific date, it was sometime between her first and second birthday, she began to just sort of slip away into her own world and lost speech, began to sort of keep to herself. It was not completely noticeable at the time, although I would have to say as a father I was a little less clued in than my wife, who was beginning to figure out that something was wrong well before I did.
Mark, are you on a regular hardline telephone?
No, I'm on my mobile phone.
Do you have a regular? Do you have access to a hardline phone? Because you don't get quite good best tone, or you don't have a hardline phone?
I do. It's a little trickier in our house for me to use it because.
All right, fine. Well, maybe during one of the sometime, if there's any way you could possibly get to the hardline phone, it would really get better tone. But be that as it may, what happened there was you took your daughter to the doctors. Did they recognize what was going on, and what did they tell you?
Well, we went through a fairly long period of workups and diagnoses. We were worried about her hearing. We thought maybe she just wasn't hearing us, so maybe she was deaf, and so she went in for a hearing test. And then we had to get in line for an evaluation, which is kind of interesting looking back on it. There were so many kids who were being affected and in the process of being assessed that it took several months for us to actually get an evaluation and then several months for them to deliver a diagnosis.
And, of course, what happened when they came up with the diagnosis? What did the medical profession suggest as far as treatment was concerned?
Well, they didn't have very good suggestions about much. They as we sat down to get the diagnosis, they had a few suggestions about the genetic test that we could take for a very rare syndrome.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Mark Blaxill, and he has a 10-year-old daughter who was autistic, born normally, and was progressing normally somewhere between the first and second year of age. She began to regress, and eventually they came up with a diagnosis of autism, went to the doctors, they confirmed the diagnosis, said something about genetic testing, and but did they have anything specifically to offer in the way of treatment or means of trying to get her better?
No, actually, not at all.
All right. So what did you do? In faced with this, and after all, the doctors, certainly if there was something there that could be done, they would tell you about it. Did they? Anybody suggest it might have been the toxic doses of mercury we were giving to our children at that time?
No, I don't think there were any suggestions. In fact, if you talk to any doctor who's delivering in a mainstream hospital who's delivering an autism diagnosis today, they'll tell you it's a disorder and there's something mysterious in the genes that they haven't figured out yet.
All right, fine. So, I mean, here you have a daughter and you love her and I'm sure you did. So, what did you do?
Well, my wife and I went home and cried for a weekend and had to sort of process everything that we'd heard, and then I think we resolved that we had to figure out what to help and to get involved. And so we called people that we knew. I mean, we that the parents would do, and most parents do. You try.
Well, did you get up on the internet and begin to find out that can be done to help the children?
Well, that one of the resources that we went to was the internet, and I was not a big internet guy at the time, but I just figured I needed to teach myself what was going on. And so there's a lot of information about it. And the one thing that you have access to on the internet is you can tap into networks of parents, other people who are going through the same experience in the same way. And I began to network on some of these listservs and discussion groups and to talk to other parents and learn from their experience.
And, of course, what did you begin to learn? What did you find out, you know, that other parents were feeling and who had really been looking into this for some time?
Yeah, well, this was late in 1998, and so I think...
Hold that right there. We'll be back in just a moment with Mark Blaxill. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Mark Blaxill. And, of course, Mark has an autistic daughter. He goes to the internet. He's not getting any help at all from organized medicine because, quite frankly, the doctors don't know. And it's not because they don't care. It is because there's a conscious effort to deceive them in the medical journals, in the medical meetings, by the leaders of organized medicine who have a different agenda. And you know, there are a few doctors out there who recognize what's happening. Usually it's the doctors who've had autistic children themselves and, of course, met the same sort of a problem that Mark did. And then, of course, they began looking into it. And many of these have given up their practices to treat the children, and they can be helped. But, of course, organized medicine doesn't want to recognize that, at least the leaders of organized medicine, because they have a different agenda. And this is, of course, the real problem we face. So as you begin talking to other parents and looking into it, what did you find?
Well, you learn some very practical things. You learn about things that parents have done that are not necessarily giving somebody Ritalin or Haloperidol or Risperidol or Prozac or whatever the drug of the moment might be. You learn that, in fact, a lot of these kids have symptoms that aren't just the autistic symptoms, but are actually general health symptoms.
And, of course, did your daughter have a lot of diarrhea, intestinal problems?
Yes. So the joys of infants with autism is you learn that diarrhea, for example, is very common, gastrointestinal distress.
And, see, nobody ever tells people about that. And of course, they have this intense diarrhea because there's an inflammation in the lining of the bowel, and then they begin to absorb all sorts of things that are very toxic for them. So pick up the story there.
Well, so we learned from other parents that there were a lot of kids just like our child, who had gastrointestinal issues, and that there were, in fact, some very simple things that you could do, particularly dietary changes that you could make, and then treatments to calm down bowel inflammation. That would make, you know, a very positive effect. It wasn't a cure, it wasn't a silver bullet, but it was something that would make her feel better and actually, you know, begin a trajectory in a positive way.
Well, now, of course, did the pediatricians or other people you talk to, regular doctors, come up with any treatments for the bowel problem?
No. Well, there were some. If you could find actually a very specific specialty, pediatric gastroenterologist, one of the most helpful mainstream doctors we worked with was someone here in Mass General, who's a very nice man, and was treating these kids as if they had bowel problems. And just specifically focused on that.
And of course, But they do have bowel problems. A significant percentage of them have inflammation of the bowel. But the question is, what triggers off the inflammation? And nobody wants to ask those questions or try to put it all together. So anyway, of course, the doctor is helping you then. Were you following his advice, or did you get on to some of the websites and find out about the special diets that do seem to help?
Well, we did follow some bits of advice from the doctor. There were some medications that were helpful, but largely we were taking ideas to our doctors most of the time, because the parents in this thing are way out ahead of most of the doctors, and most of the doctors that are helpful are actually in an entirely different category. They're often parents themselves, but there is a group of doctors that are often called the DAN doctors. It's an organization that loosely affiliates this group.
And that's a Defeat Autism Now, Dan. And, of course, these are doctors who are really, in many respects, risking their professions by trying to help these children because, of course, they are sorely criticized by organized medicine. How dare you say there's something wrong with these children? But go ahead.
So there is a very helpful group of doctors and clinicians that once you find them, they can be wonderful. And they're all talking to one another. And they're, you know, right up there with the parents in terms of what's going on. So we found our way to some very helpful doctors in this group, but it wasn't the normal pathway that we would have followed if we'd just gone to our pediatrician, our regular pediatrician, to the regular Boston area hospitals. It was a very different path.
All right, fine. So then, of course, did you get onto special diets as far as your daughter was concerned?
Yes. Well, there is a specific diet that a lot of parents have found useful, which is take milk and wheat out of their diet.
Take milk and wheat out of the diet. Go ahead.
Yes, it's called the gluten casein-free diet. And there were some ideas for why that worked. Actually, there's a lot of interesting ideas scientifically why it helps the kids. And those change a bit over time. But the one thing that parents do learn is that when you remove milk and you remove wheat products, that somehow a fog seems to lift and these kids start doing better. And we took milk out of our daughter's diet, and within almost hours, we saw a difference.
And of course, it's almost like the fog lifts.
Yes.
And the mind begins to work again.
Yes, the mind starts working. It starts kicking in. Again, it wasn't a magic bullet. It wasn't a cure. But all of a sudden, there was something positive. And then immediately we turned to wheat. And actually, the wheat didn't seem to be as big a deal as the milk, but then our doctor told us to try to put her back on wheat for a while. This is an interesting story. We didn't want to put her back on wheat because we were worried, but the doctor wanted to do a procedure in which he could test for wheat allergy in her intestines. So we put a very measured amount of wheat into her diet, and the day that we introduced wheat back into her diet, she was scheduled for a session with a speech therapist who had been working with us for 6 or 9 months. And right in the middle of the session, this woman who we knew very well came down the stairs and said, "I'm sorry, I don't know what's gone wrong, but you shouldn't charge me for this session. We've just lost every bit of progress that we've made in the last 6 months."
All right, so this, of course, is a typical story we've heard. Would it be any way you could possibly get onto that other telephone, because we're having real difficulty with... we've got about 6 minutes before we go to our next break, 5 minutes, and maybe if there's any way you could get on to another telephone, because your voice keeps sort of dropping out on us. Anyway, of course, now you've got her on a diet, and what happens? How old is she now?
This is when she's 3.
Okay, fine. And so what happens then?
And, you know, we eventually lock into a model of therapy that seems to to make progress. I mean, we work very hard on normalizing her intestinal issues. We work hard on, you know, a whole range of ideas, you know, in terms of different supplements, different dietary issues, and all of them seem to help. I mean, again, none of them are a cure, but all of them help. And she starts making progress, and we also, by the way, get therapy, intensive one-on-one therapy with you know, just to improve her learning pace and her language and a whole set of things like that.
Well, how is she coming with her speaking now?
Well, she's 10. She's certainly not. She's in a special school environment. She's not like a normal 10-year-old. On the other hand, if we were to take her in for an autism diagnosis today, or take her in for a workup today, the diagnosis we would get would probably not be autism. It would probably be something more like developmental language delay. But she's got a lot of language. She talks a lot. She's very social. She's a wonderful little girl, and she's doing really well.
Well, now, Chris, are you getting any help from the government as far as her education? Are you having to pay for a lot of this yourself?
Well, we've actually worked very hard with our local school district, and we're very pleased with the support that we've gotten. We have her in a great school. We've had, there have been some active negotiations, and my wife has worked really hard on that. But I think all in all, we're very happy with the education.
Basically, of course, the school then it has to have a special school, special programs, special teachers for developmentally handicapped children.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you're very, very fortunate to have a school, you know, in your area that will do that, because it's really a very, very expensive proposition. And, you know, in areas where they don't have this, this has simply bankrupted the families. Now, what about the Mercury? Do you feel that there's any part that Mercury has played in this as you begin to study this whole issue?
Well, the thing that I really got involved in over time was to try to get a deeper understanding of what might have happened, because one of the things that you learn when you talk to other parents, and in fact, you know, speaking from California, I mean, I think this is where some of the most important information came from. There's an explosion in autism around the country. This is not a normal situation. We're not looking at a genetic stable disorder. We have an epidemic on our hands.
And we just did not have this before. This has suddenly happened and really started when, about the 1980s or 1990s?
Late 1980s and really exploded in through the early 1990s.
And of course,
at least a tenfold increase autism around the country.
A tenfold increase all around the country. And it's not simply because they're making the diagnosis. This is something that they just didn't have when I went to medical school. You know, we didn't even talk about autism. This was nothing that was ever mentioned. And in fact, we didn't really hear about it until about 1990. And suddenly, this dramatic increase. And fortunately, here in California, they do track this. And so these cases are reportable. They keep records, and you see this thing shooting straight on up in the air. And, of course, these are children, you know, who are seriously handicapped. We've gone from about one autism case in 10,000 to one in 166 children. And, of course, many of the other children who do not have frank autism have ADD and ADHD, and they have Asperger's disease, and they have learning disabilities, and they have speech disabilities, and they have behavioral disabilities. Why is this happening? Why suddenly? What happened somewhere there in the late 1980s? Now, we did have it before then, and of course, many people felt it was related to the DPT shots, but something happened in the late 1980s that has triggered this terrible, terrible tragedy up. Well, Mike, do you think you can get another telephone? If not, why, we'll just keep going the way we are.
Well, I could give you another number to call, yes.
All right, fine. Well, I'm going to then ask my producer. I'm going to hang up. I'm going to put you on hold and ask my producer to get that other number, and we'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. And if our producer will pick up that call, we'll try the other line. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is such an important subject. I really want all of our listeners to understand that they're destroying the lives of our children. We've gone from 1 in 100, 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 166, and so many of our other children have difficulties. According to the Centers for Disease Control, 1 in 6 American children has either autism or Asperger's disease or ADD or ADHD or speaking or reading or certainly learning disabilities in the United States. Do you honestly think that has simply happened by accident? Well, we just certainly want to point this out. There is a problem. There's a serious problem. And, of course, the government is doing everything they can to keep it up. Keep it quiet. The last thing they want is for the American people to learn the truth. And then, of course, if you get into the background about 3 or 4 months ago, almost as if by order, and, of course, it was in the media, in radio, in television, and all of our major news magazines, and all of our major newspapers, all at one time, they were suddenly talking about this epidemic of autism, this terrible epidemic of autism. But, of course, they wanted people to know there was really nothing you could much do for it, and certainly it was not in any way related to the vaccines, and it was not in any way related to mercury, and the CDC would assure you that the mercury in the vaccines had nothing to do with this, and it had nothing to do with the measles vaccine, and there was nothing you could do for the children, so don't waste your time trying to treat them. Just go ahead and get them into a special learning program for mentally handicapped. Do you remember when the propaganda campaign came out about 3 or 4 months ago, Mike?
Well, it's kind of a nonstop propaganda campaign. And so, there have been a number of them, a number of waves. I think the concern is, and this is, it's become a controversial issue. It shouldn't be, in my mind. I mean, I think all of us should be, pretty comfortable with the idea that healthy children is something all of us should want, and it's not a controversy at all. But when you have something like this autism epidemic, you obviously have to think, well, what happened? What's different? You know, what changed? We didn't have this when I was a kid. What's different between, you know, when I grew up and when my children are growing up? And there are a lot of theories, and people have a lot of ideas for what might have changed. But one very obvious thing that has changed is that we've had, you know, a pretty large escalation in the childhood immunization program. That when you grow up and I grew up, I'm not sure how old you are, Stan, but you know, I'm in my 40s, and I knew I got some shots when I was a kid, but there weren't that many. It was the DPT shot and smallpox and polio, and you got them kind of, you know, late in childhood, and that was about it. But for kids today, there's a very expensive schedule, and you've got, you know, the same old shots, DPT and so forth, and polio, but you also have a whole new set of required immunizations, including hepatitis B and measles, mumps, rubella, and Haemophilus influenza B, and even chickenpox now. So there's a whole set of new required programs for kids, and that's different. And so as a parent, you're sitting and looking at this, and you know that you have autoimmune problems in your child, that they have an inflammatory reaction in their guts. That's where the diarrhea comes from.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest today is Mark Blaxell, and of course, his 10-year-old daughter has autism, although she's made a considerable improvement. But Mark was saying that, you know, you have to ask yourself why this is. When he was growing up, why we did not have autism, it was not widespread across America. And so many of the parents are saying, what's different today than what it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago? Mark is in his 40s, because I'm in my 70s. I remember when I was growing up, we had DPT, and then, of course, we had smallpox. That was it. It wasn't until I was actually in my training that we actually got the polio vaccine. But now, of course, the children not only get DPT and polio, but they also get hepatitis B. They do that in the nursery because, of course, they're afraid that nobody would take it if they didn't get it started in the nursery. The people who really need it won't take it, so that's a grand experiment. And then they give us the measles, mumps, and rubella, and they're giving the certainly the uh, Haemophilus influenza, and we're giving the chicken pox, and there's so many vaccines, and they've got a whole flock of new vaccines they want to experiment on our children with. But of course, some of the parents are asking, is this where this epidemic came from? So pick up the story there, Mark.
So obviously it's a candidate. I mean, most of the parents I know are not anti-vaccine. We are the parents that took our kids to the doctor on time. I mean, we're very careful about following the rules and following good advice and doing what the best for our children. But then we looked and something happened, and we look around and we see we have a lot of company. There are a lot of other parents and children in the same situation. And so you look at so the vaccine changes are an obvious hypothesis, an obvious potential cause. And so that raises suspicions. And not everybody has figured everything out, but it's obviously one thing to think about. And then what you see is this enormous defensive reaction on the part of our public health. People don't say, "Oh, geez, that's interesting. Maybe there's a problem. Maybe we should do some work." What they do is, instead of professing concern and demonstrating concern for the increases and for the epidemic, they rush to the defense of their policy programs. And when you see the defense, what happens is you get an interesting idea. And there's a doctor in England who did some work and discovered this pattern of diarrhea in children.
That was Dr. Wakefield, wasn't it?
Dr. Wakefield, right. And he linked it to possible exposure to the measles mumps rubella vaccine. And his work, by the way, has never been contradicted in terms of what he found, clinically at the molecular level. It's been impeccable. It's been replicated many, many times. But if you were to read the public press, Dr. Wakefield is this villain, of all modern medicine. He's been vilified and ostracized. But the man is one of the great heroes of this whole episode.
Well, I think the story about Andrew Wakefield is the fact that he was attacked because he began actually doing colonoscopies on the children with this intense diarrhea. He found out that they had hypertrophied lymph nodes in their intestine, and of course, if you biopsy them, you would actually grow the measles virus out of there.
Right.
So there's live measles virus, and instead of saying, "Well, gee, maybe we could do something about it," they attacked him. In other words, why would they want to destroy Dr. Wakefield? They got him fired. They got him to the point where he actually had to leave England and come to the United States. Why would they attack a man who is trying to help children unless there was some sort of an agenda that there were people who didn't want to help the children? I mean, what other explanation would there be? They've done everything they could to ruin his career. They plagued him. He's come to the United States, tried to continue his work, and they're doing everything to continue attacking him. Why would they do that to a man who was just trying to help children?
Well, I think Andy Wakefield's a terrific guy, and I think he's done, terrific. He's a great scientist and a really disciplined and honorable man. I wouldn't want to speculate on the motives for those who attack him. I do believe that there is an ideological position that a lot of these people come from, and they simply believe, because they think it must be true, that all vaccines are good. And so they're unwilling intellectually just to accept the notion that there might be a risk.
But wouldn't you think that intelligent, educated, moral people would want to look at all sides and reevaluate the scientific basis? After all, science is a search for truth.
Absolutely.
Seems to be destroying anybody who tries to do something to help the children. That's frightening.
It's very concerning.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment with Mark Blaxill. Mark Blaxill, and he works with Safe Minds. Is this your organization, or you just work with it, Mark?
I am one of the leaders of Safe Minds, yes.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment. You can find them at www.safeminds.org. And remember, next it could be one of your children or one of your grandchildren. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Mark Blaxill, and we're talking about autism, and the terrible, terrible tragedy is one in six American children has some sort of a neurodevelopmental abnormality, and they're not all autistic. That's only about one in, what was it, 166, something like that, Mark?
That's right, yeah.
All right, fine. And so we see this vicious attack on Dr. Andrew Wakefield, for, you know, finding out that there seemed to be some sort of a definite relationship between the autism and, of course, it was his belief, it was the measles vaccine. So what is the current status on that?
Well, the tricky part of the MMR issue is that there's no question that a lot of these kids have bowel problems, and that's what Andrew Wakefield is. He's a pediatric gastroenterologist, and he has found this characteristic pattern of what he calls lymphoid nodular hyperplasia, which is, you know, swollen lymph nodes in the intestines. And so these kids are sick in a definable way, and that he found it again and again and again. It's been replicated by many other doctors. They see this pattern in lots of these kids. The thing that doesn't fit, you know, and you're tempted to say, well, geez, then the MMR causes autism. It's you know, simple cause and effect. Well, the problem is that, you know, in the U.S., for example, the MMR was introduced in 1979, and we didn't really have the epidemic, the sharp rise in autism rates until the 90s, and we had pretty good coverage of MMR in the 1980s. So a simple story that goes MMR autism doesn't really fit the facts. And you know, and while it's very clear that there's some connection clinically with these kids, it's not as obvious that there's just a simple single cause that you can associate with MMR. And so, and that's one of the reasons, and that's how they've been able to attack him, because there isn't not a simple, you know, a simple one-step answer. But Andy, by the way, has never made that argument that there's a simple, you know, cause that, you know, that cause that MMR drives all of autism. He's just raising a caution. So that's part of the problem. It's a bigger mystery than just, you know, a single vaccine has caused this whole epidemic.
What about the part that mercury plays as far as the its toxicity on the brain?
Well, and that's, you know, another chapter in this discussion. So Andy, interestingly, came out with this study. His original study was in 1998, which was almost a month after my daughter was diagnosed. So that was almost my, you know, introduction to the whole disease, was this controversy in this new paper. But a couple of years later, a paper came out.
Hold that thought there in just a moment. We'll be right back with Mark Blaxall.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mark Blaxall. Mark, go ahead and pick up the story. Mark was just saying that certainly we can't attribute all of autism to the measles, mumps, and the rubella virus. These are live viruses that are given to children because they started in the late 1970s, and we really didn't see the epidemic start until the late 1980s, about 10 years later. And Dr. Wakefield, who has been so viciously prosecuted and persecuted for daring to suggest there was some relationship to the constant enterocolitis and diarrhea these unfortunate children have, because, of course, he was able to find the live measles virus in their intestine. Dr. Wakefield has never said that this is the only cause of autism. It is simply that they seem to be associated, the colitis, the measles virus in the gut. But are there other causes? So then I simply had asked the question, what about the mercury in the vaccines? And so, Mark, go ahead and pick up the story there.
Well, another chapter in the science came out a couple years after Dr. Wakefield's paper, which was this paper that began circulating that was written by some parents, in which they made the observation that there were a lot of connections between the symptoms of autism and the broad biological symptoms, all the things that we were seeing in our kids, not just the neurological and behavioral issues, but also the colitis and other autoimmune issues, and the list gets very long. But there was a connection between those symptoms, the symptoms of autism, and the things that mercury could do when you saw the symptoms of mercury poisoning. And so this was a working paper, and it was called Autism, a Novel Form of Mercury Poisoning. It was circulating in 2000 and was published, actually, in 2000 in a journal called Medical Hypotheses. And this paper suggested that that the new exposures to mercury in vaccines, because because mercury was used as a preservative in three specific vaccines, that those exposures might have been responsible for the symptoms of autism and also for the epidemic increase in autism, because the mercury exposure in the children, unlike the MMR vaccine, the increases in mercury did really explode in the 1990s, right in parallel with the increase in autism rates.
And of course, that we find it in hepatitis B vaccine, we find it in DPT. What other vaccines was it in?
Well, there were three. The DPT had always had mercury in the form of this preservative thimerosal. But in the early 1990s, we added two more mercury-containing vaccines to the schedule, one of which was hepatitis B, and the other was this Haemophilus influenza B, or we call it HIB. And DPT by itself, each shot had about 25 micrograms of mercury, and you would get three or four shots. But each HIB shot had an additional 25, and the hepatitis B shots had about 12.5 micrograms per shot. So you add all these shots up, and you went from about a 75 microgram exposure level over a long period of time up to about 187, 200 micrograms of mercury through the whole course of the immunization schedule. So you effectively almost tripled the amount of mercury exposure, and you also multiplied the amount of mercury exposure very early in infancy in the first few months of life.
And, of course, the big problem is, the brain is developing very, very rapidly during the first few months of life, and they're giving this in the nursery. Why would you give something like that in the nursery when this is not a major problem in our country?
Well, in my own personal opinion, I think every vaccine should be a discussion. Every vaccine discussion should be one of the risks and benefits, because the risks of the diseases are real. There's no question you don't want to get diphtheria. Diphtheria kills people, and it's a bad disease. And so, immunizations serve an important and useful role. But you have to weigh the benefits of the vaccines against the risks. And something like hepatitis B is a very, very rare disease in infants. There's some controversy about how many. But the only way that an infant will get infected with hepatitis B is if the mother is infected with hepatitis B. And that's a test that the mother can take. And so the reason that we're getting it in the nursery is because it's simply easier for everyone to get covered, including the infected, the people that need it, by mandating the vaccine, as opposed to actually being careful about discriminating between who needs it and who doesn't.
All right, fine. So suddenly our children are getting massive doses of mercury, far in excess of what the Environmental Protection Agency says is safe. In fact, I'm not sure there's any level of mercury that is safe, like lead. And, of course, they keep lowering the level of lead till they finally said there's no safe level. And I think it's the same is true with the mercury, and they're just telling people, you just shouldn't, you shouldn't eat fish too much because you'll get mercury intoxication, but we're going to give it to your child, a toxic dose to your child in the nursery? That doesn't make sense.
Well, and if you actually, if you take the vaccine, the concentrations of mercury in vaccines, it qualifies it many times over as a toxic waste. You have to have something like 200 parts per billion to be classified as a toxic waste, and mercury-containing vaccines have on the order of 50,000 parts per billion. So it's many, many times above the threshold to be a toxic waste.
All right, fine. So then what happened is certainly the parents were beginning to be very, very concerned about the fact that they were giving toxic doses of mercury to our children. And, of course, didn't eventually the American Academy of Pediatrics and some government agencies come out and say, hey, maybe we ought to take the mercury out of childhood vaccines in the United States, but we'll leave them in for the rest of the world. Why would you take them out of the United States and give them to children throughout the rest of the world? And there's even the possibility that they were going to damage the minds of children in third world countries.
Well, an important thing to remember is they're not out of vaccines in the United States now, because one of the things that's gone on is a campaign to defend thimerosal, and in part because I think people believe that we need it for the flu vaccine. And so pregnant women and infants starting at 6 months are now recommended to get a flu vaccine, and flu vaccines, 90% of flu vaccines contain mercury.
Well, why would you want to give this to a pregnant woman? It would concentrate in the brain, brain of the child in her uterus, and isn't there some evidence that actually it increases the rate of abortion? Does certainly in animals.
I think there is some evidence that suggests that mercury does all sorts of nasty things, including increasing miscarriage.
So. But then why would the CDC recommend that this be given to pregnant women, specifically in the first trimester, when, of course, the child is developing the most rapidly?
I think my personal theory is that we have a bureaucracy that's run amok. Everybody has their own theories, and I think bureaucracies develop their own logic and their own goals. You have in the CDC is a people that's very worried at ease now. And flu, as we read about in the newspapers every day now, flu is the growth industry for the infectious disease bureaucracy. And they like programs, they like to expand, they like to take on new work and to extend their influence and reach. So building a flu vaccine program that works is actually a very difficult program to manage and run. Takes a lot of work, and because most people, not a lot of people, get really sick from the flu. The risks of flu are greatly exaggerated. Very few people die, even though the CDC claims 36,000 people a year die. That's an overstatement by orders of magnitude. So my personal theory is it's just a government bureaucracy looking for new work to do. Other people have different ideas, your listeners are welcome to have their own. But in my view, it's an example of government overreaching itself.
Well, certainly one of the things that I think any of our listeners should be aware of the fact is that they keep talking about avian flu and the pandemic of avian flu, which is absolutely true. There is a pandemic of avian flu, and millions have died. Millions of birds.
That's right.
But, of course, what they're trying to do is equate in the minds of people the threat of avian flu with the standard flu, and so everybody's got to get vaccinated or they're going to die. But very, very few people die. This idea of 36,000 people to die, they will say they die of a flu and, of course, associated conditions, which are really talking about pneumonia, and people are always dying of pneumonia.
Right.
And so anyway, I mean, this is a disease of older people, and that's why they're dying, not necessarily get the flu, although I'm sure occasionally you'll have people get the flu, and the weakened condition will contribute to death. But I think they're exaggerating. Is that your impression?
Yeah, absolutely. No, and you actually look at the statistics. I think only something like a few hundred deaths every year are actually documented as being caused by influenza. But there is this category, as you said, of influenza and pneumonia, and that's the category that's large. And there's a theory that influenza leads to pneumonia, which it can sometimes. But there are a lot of things that can lead to pneumonia. And this model and these estimates, which are not hard numbers, this number that you always hear, 36,000 deaths from the flu, is just statistics. It's not real. It's not documented. It's somebody's model. And it's somebody that wants to make the case for everyone to get a flu shot.
Well, the old adage, of course, that people are always making up statistics, and believe me, they're making up statistics there at the CDC because they have an agenda and they want to convince you got to take it. But why would you give this to pregnant women? There is no evidence, that the influenza increases morbidity or mortality in pregnant women. So why would you want to give them something that could seriously damage the forming fetus? This is the thing that really mystifies me.
It mystifies a lot of us. And there have been studies done, and there are actually no clinical benefits of the flu shot in pregnant women.
All right, there could be very some deleterious effects to the children, and this is something entirely new. Knowing full well that many people are concerned about the danger of thimerosal, they've suddenly said initially it was only in third trimester pregnancies and then second trimester, and now at any time, first trimester, and many of the women unfortunately to go into the doctor, and the first thing he says the first time they see them early in the pregnancy is, well, we've got to get you an influenza shot because the government has mandated it, or at least has suggested it. Is the government mandating or just suggesting?
It's recommended. And
so that puts the doctor into a very defensive position, doesn't it? He's really supposed to go along with what's recommended by the people in Atlanta.
That's right. And there are different ways of enforcing the rules, and one of the things that really adds teeth to the childhood immunization program is that you can't get into school until you've gotten fully vaccinated. So that's really a part of the deal. I don't think a mother getting an influenza shot has the same weight of stopping people from participating in society, but pregnant women are going to their prenatal checkups, and I think it's part of the recommended protective prenatal program that an obstetrician will go through with a pregnant woman, and so. A lot of pregnant women are getting encouraged and taking the advice of their doctor and getting a flu shot.
But are there any studies that show that it is not harmful to the child? In fact, my understanding is if you read the brochure, they will tell you on the influenza shot that there is no evidence, it's not been experimented with women and pregnant women, and there's no evidence it's safe.
Giving mercury, exposing children and infants and fetuses to mercury on purpose is just stupid. There's no good reason to do it.
Well, but I mean, they even admit in the package insert that there is no evidence that it's been safe. It's not been tried. It's not been proven safe. And yet doctors are recommending it. And you have to wonder, do they ever read the package insert? And I will tell you, they don't. I know I never read those package inserts when I was practicing. The print is so small, you have to have a magnifying glass to see it. Why do they make the print so small nobody can read it? Unless maybe they have another agenda. Under any circumstances, what would you recommend for a parent or a grandparent that has an autistic child?
Well, I would recommend that they find and get online. And I mean, if a lot of people don't like it, it's a good reason to get trained because you can learn a lot from your comrades in arms in this journey. And I think I would recommend that people get educated about the biomedical options. There are a lot of things that you can do that are non-invasive, that are not toxic, that are not pharmacological, that can help boost the immune system, that can help reduce inflammation, that can help these kids detoxify to the extent that heavy metals are involved. And there are a lot of natural, very helpful things that you can do. And these kids do start improving. They do get better, and there are all sorts of stories. One of the things that mobilizes the parents most is that when they do this and when they start listening to one another, it works. And, it helps.
And would you suggest that people go to www.safeminds.org?
Certainly. We are very focused ourselves on science and trying to encourage the pursuit of the truth with respect to these environmental exposures, and we're very interested in investigating the mercury theory. But there are other websites that people could go to. I would say the Autism Research Institute, which is, I think, www.ari.org. I have that right. Defeat Autism Now. You can do a search on Defeat Autism Now. There are lots of doctors that can help. There's a website called Generation Rescue that's very helpful on suggesting detoxification therapies, and we're good friends with the folks at Generation Rescue. The National Autism Association is another good website. So there are any number of parent organizations that I think are very helpful. I think a parent first introduced to this, or a grandparent, needs to get educated. And there's a lot of resources that people can look to.
What about the chelation? Has this helped some of the children, do you think? And that's coagulation, of course, I'm referring to the various shots or IVs or certainly they even sometimes will put things onto the skin that will actually tend to draw the mercury out of the child's system. So is there any evidence that this is helpful?
Well, there's not a lot of hard scientific studies in print, and it's worth emphasizing that. But there are a lot of reports from parents who talk to one another that chelation is helping their children.
And this they call it chelation. Of course, they put in a product there that will actually tend to draw the mercury out. And what they do, many times they will actually take urine specimens both before and after the chelation, and they'll find a massive excretion of mercury in the autistic children. Of course, children that are, you know, not autistic will not get that sort of a mercury release. So there really seems to be a great deal to show that if you can get the mercury out of the child, many of them will do much better. We're going to be back in just a moment with Mark to wrap up the program. And, of course, his website is www.safeminds.org. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Mark Blaxell. And, Mark, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Say anything I want to
say. You can say whatever you want to for 3 minutes.
Well, you know, I can't stress enough how important this is. I think we have way too many sick children. And as a parent and as a father, there's nothing more important than taking care of your kids. That's what we're here for. And you just look around, and you can't escape the fact that there are tens of children, whether it's because they have autism or PDD or ADHD or life-threatening peanut allergies or asthma or diabetes. We have the sickest generation of children in this country that we've had certainly in my lifetime. And we need to ask ourselves the question, what happened? Why are so many children sick? And when you see this kind of change in the health of a childhood population, you have to ask the question, well, what's happened in their environment that's different? And really that's the issue. I wouldn't pretend to have all the answers in terms of the science and the etiology. I think a lot of these issues are complicated, as anyone who spent any time on this would acknowledge. But I think what we need to do is not try to defend an abstraction, a program like, a particular immunization schedule. We're immunizing children in order to make them healthy. We're not sacrificing children because we want to promote the widespread adoption of a government program. So I think we've got things backward, and we need to ask the question, why are these children sick? And we need to treat all the environmental causes and theories about causes seriously and do the serious work that needs to be done to figure out how to turn this situation around. I don't think anybody would say that mercury is not a dangerous substance. It's one of the most toxic substances known to man. And when you get into the science, you learn pretty quickly that it makes a lot of sense that mercury could cause a lot of these problems. We don't know exactly how. We don't know exactly every pathway. And we haven't gotten into some of the minutiae of the science. But I can say, having read and studied and actually written a few scientific articles myself on the subject, that I'm pretty persuaded that mercury is not the only cause of autism, certainly a very important cause of some of the increases.
Well, Mark, we're just about out of time, but I really want to thank you very much for being with us. And certainly, if you'd like to get more information, the website, www.safeminds.org. That's safeminds.org. Thanks very much for being with us. Hope we can get you on again.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we certainly need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do have to pay for the time on many of our stations, and it's an expensive proposition to be on 60 stations every week. If you believe that you're going to hear information here you're not going to get elsewhere, if you are concerned about what's happening to our children and why, we hope many of you will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters as we reach out across America. 5 hours a day on radio and on the internet, and 4 hours a day on shortwave, and 9 hours a day on satellite now, and on a number of different satellites. We have the opportunity to reach people all throughout the world, but quite frankly, we need your help. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know more about the issue of autism, we have a book called Evidence of Harm by David Kirby, an excellent book, not emotional at all, just telling of the story of what we do know. We have a four-tape set on autism. We have two four-tape sets on mercury, and not only the mercury that are in the injections, but the mercury and the fillings that many people have in their mouth, and why there's been an organized effort to block dentists from doing what I believe they should do, and which I've done myself, and that is to get the toxic doses of mercury, which are constantly being vented from the fillings, get them out of people, especially out of pregnant women and certainly the elderly. There's a definite relationship between between Alzheimer's disease and influenza shots. And those of you who would like to get the web page from Dr. Fudenberg, the abstract from his web page, where he points out 1,000% increase in the incidence of Alzheimer's disease if you follow your doctor's advice and you're between 60 and 65 and you take 3 to 4 influenza shots over a 5-year period between 60 and 65, 1,000% increase in Alzheimer's disease. If you'd like that documentation, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we have an excellent video on mercury, and all of these things are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and ask for the book, Evidence of Harm, for the four-tape set on autism, for the 2 4-tape sets on mercury, for the video on mercury, and, of course, it's called Uninformed Consent is the title video, and you'll actually see the smoking tooth. It's a tooth taken out with a filling in it, and of course with the temperature you'd have when you drank some hot coffee. You can actually see the mercury venting on the video, and they use a mercury meter, a mercury screen, and this is going on all the time. They've taken sheep and they've filled their teeth with mercury and see what happened when they chew food, and of course it gets right into the brain. The video is entitled Mercury, a Slow Death is the title. Mercury, a Slow Death, and of course it's called Uninformed Consent. All of these are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. And then if you really want to put things into perspective, you need to get my talk. It's called Planned Population Reduction. It goes into mercury and fluoride and aspartame and vaccinations and so much more. Planned Population Reduction, available on video or DVD, and you'll never look at the world through the same eyes again. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Go to our webpage at RadioLiberty.com. Remember, we do carry the Big Berkey products. If you'd like to have a safe source of water, if there was sort of a crisis situation. And then, of course, please tell others about our programs and pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.